Welcome to Post Carbon Radio. I'm your host, Bing Gong, with co-host Karin Nyhus. Today, our show is about fossil fuel divestment campaigns on college campuses and exploring local companies investing in fossil fuels, including the Dakota Access Pipeline. We have two guests today. In the studio, we have Helen Kane, who is a 21-year-old senior at Barnard College, a private women's liberal arts college affiliated with Columbia University in New York City. She's here in Point Reyes Station during the holiday season visiting her mom, Sarah Kane, and aunt, Pamela Wright. Helen is a co-founder of the fossil fuel divestment campaign at Barnard College called Divest Barnard, an effective year-long student campaign to convince Barnard's administration and board of trustees to consider divesting its endowment from fossil fuel companies. Welcome to Post Carbon Radio, Helen.
Thank you for having me. And on the phone in Santa Cruz, we have Will Parrish. Here's a quote from a Counterpunch article on Will by Cal Winslow. Quote, Will Parrish is a young journalist in Mendocino County. He's a rare type in his field these days. He is fearless. He takes on the hard targets, the biggest ones he can find, and he writes with passion and commitment. If we still have muckrakers, literary crusaders in the best sense, he's one. In October, Will wrote an article in the North Bay Bohemian about SPO partners in Mill Valley and other Bay Area financial institutions that are invested in the Dakota Access Pipeline. Welcome to Post Carbon Radio, Will.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
All right. So here we are the day after Christmas, and a lot of people's minds may be taking a needed break from the troubles of the world. I noticed in Petaluma, where I live, a lot fewer Christmas decorations up this year. I myself am not a Christian, and I don't celebrate this holiday very much, but I read the absence of many colorful twinkling lights as a sign, maybe, of the worried time we're in. I read it as a sign of the uncertainty and fear a lot of people in Northern California are experiencing as we anticipate a Trump presidency. I hear fear being expressed for vulnerable people in our communities, fear for what this presidency means for the climate, fear for what it means for the economy, and much more.
Yeah, with the election of Donald Trump for president and his nominations for his cabinet of climate denialists, of billionaires and generals, we who care about our environment and the future of the planet and a livable climate face extraordinary challenges that make the work of the climate movement much more difficult.
Yeah, but being at the same time, you know, we've got these two guests, and both of you are working on not just the fight back against Trump, but also the longer-term struggles for a hopeful agenda in terms of climate and in terms of social justice.
Helen, you were instrumental in the research and writing of a 60-page Barnard College Presidential Task Force on Divestment report to enable the Committee on Investments and subsequently the Board of Trustees to make an informed decision about whether to seek divestment from companies that extract, process, distribute, and sell fossil fuels. Over the course of nine months, the task force weighed the financial and fiduciary responsibilities of the board to grow the value of Barnard's endowment and the moral and ethical issues surrounding Barnard's responsibility to do its part to address the climate change issue. Helen, give us a bit of the historical background of the divestment campaigns on college campuses.
Sure. So the divestment campaign really started in earnest in 2012, and I think a lot of people know about the Do the Math tour that Bill McKibben did and his seminal article in Rolling Stone about doing the math on the climate crisis. But it's less known that the divestment movement on college campuses actually began in 2010 at Swarthmore College with a group called Swarthmore Mountain Justice. And I find that origin of the divestment movement really to be pretty inspiring because there's this narrative of Bill McKibben and sort of the leaders of 350.org as being the organizers of this campaign. But it really did start with its roots all the way back in the beginning with the foundation in climate justice. So Swarthmore Mountain Justice began their campaign as a response to coal miners in West Virginia. They went to visit these coal miners in West Virginia and see the devastation of mountaintop removal. And the local coal miners asked the students in Swarthmore Mountain Justice to return to their campuses, and rather than rather than volunteer or come to West Virginia in person to mobilize the capital and the resources that they had at their university for the sake of building a broader movement. And that was how fossil fuel divestment as a movement began. So those are the origins that sort of inspire me and the folks in my campaign as well.
Well, how did you get involved at Barnard to lead or co-found the movement?
Well, it came from a lot of different directions. I think a lot of my interests sort of combined at once, but two of the biggest sort of factors that led me in that direction were the Keystone XL pipeline march, the anti-Keystone XL pipeline march that I went to in March of 2014.
I was there too.
Yeah, yeah. In March of 2014 in Washington, D.C., and meeting a bunch of folks there from other college campuses who already had thriving campaigns that I was able to learn from and take that back to Barnard. And then additionally, I had been involved in student government for a while already on campus, and it just felt like I was banging my head against a wall, trying to get anything done sustainability-wise through student government or through the administration just simply was not working. And I sort of came to the conclusion that mobilization had to occur from the outside.
So what's the argument for divestment? Lay it out, the basics for us.
Different people interpret it differently, but the sort of theory that that speaks to me most is that divestment is a mechanism of raising an issue to a higher level in public discourse. So divestment from South Africa is a great example, but the divestment concept in general is you take your money out of a particular industry, and in doing so, you're going to have to be talking about why you do it. You're going to have to be publicly debating it. You're going to have to be raising this issue up and educating people on it. And because you're taking your money out of this industry, you're also saying that you refuse to have financial ties to a particular industry. So in the case of the fossil fuel industry, by removing your money from the fossil fuel industry, you're explicitly identifying that financial connections and climate change are connected and we all are sort of implicit. Where we put our money matters. But you're also saying that you're going to take a public stand and identify that the industry as a whole is immoral and you're unwilling to invest in it. So it's really a matter of compliance, I think, and complicity in the industry as a whole and taking a stand against it as opposed to the financial implications.
As opposed to? I was going to ask you that.
Yeah. So I think, you know, a lot of critics of the divestment movement will say just because colleges in America take their money out of the fossil fuel divestment industry or the fossil fuel industry, that won't make even a little dent in their ability to raise money and to do the projects that they're currently doing. It's not a matter of crippling the industry with the money that we remove. It's a matter of creating a stigma around the industry that will force politicians to take action that actually could impact these industries. So creating regulations, creating, taking away subsidies, various ways that politicians can raise up this issue and that will actually impact the industry that colleges don't have the power to do with their access to money, but it stigmatizes the industry as a whole.
So let's say you researched and wrote the report and gave it to the Board of Trustees, and now what's the status of that report now?
It's a little bit in a holding pattern. So it's basically just being deliberated right now. We delivered the report in their latest board meeting, December 6th and 7th was when the board members received the report. And the investment committee looked at the report very favorably. It looks as though they're going to recommend the recommendation that was written in the report. And that recommendation is that the college divests from all companies that deny or impede climate science and climate action. So our expectation, my expectation, and the expectation of the other students in my campaign is that the full board will vote on this in March and that they will accept the recommendation.
And we all know the science. Just to go over it again, is that Bill McKibben's figured out the math, and he says that we need to leave 80% of the oil in the ground if we're going to have a livable climate. And James Hansen has said that We can't go above 350 parts per million, but we're already over 400 to keep the temperature down 1.5 degrees Celsius. Do you want to talk about a little bit about the report, what's in it, and how it differs maybe from other divestment campaigns?
Yeah, so the report is interesting because it sort of takes a different look at divestment. And I really have been impressed with the administration of Barnard over the past few months, sort of really grappling with issues that students have been arguing about for years now with their administrations, but the most administration's not really willing to take the time to look at. And one sort of direction that they decided to approach divestment from has been academic integrity, which is not what the students would have hoped in an ideal world they would choose. But this report has found that because of the way that the fossil fuel industry has clouded climate science, attacked climate scientists, impeded their ability to take action on climate change in a meaningful way, that there's been really irreparable damage that the industry has caused. And different companies, theoretically, we don't know yet, but theoretically, different companies are more or their practices are more or less bad, essentially, in terms of their inhibiting climate action. So the report recommends that Barnard College, in combination with the Union of Concerned Scientists, which that organization has done a lot of work on this front as well, vet all the companies that we are invested in, analyze them using very specific criteria on the behavior of each of these companies and say, okay, based on the destruction, based on the amount of money that they've put into, various lobbying groups, based on their relationship with ALEC and different ways that they have impeded our legal systems and political systems, how does that stand in opposition to the academic integrity of our institution and to climate science?
If you're just joining us, this is KWMR. You're listening to Post Carbon Radio. I'm your co-host, Karin Nyhus, with Bing Gong, and that was the voice of Helen Kane. Helen is visiting us from Chile, New York. She's a student at Barnard College, and she's involved in the fossil fuel divestment campaign. We will shortly be also joined, and we already have on the line, Will Parrish, who's an investigative journalist who's really been shining some light on some of the big hitters investing in the fossil fuel industry right here in the Bay Area and their connections to Standing Rock. So stay with us, and let's continue with our interview.
Yeah. What is that figure that institutions have committed to divestment now?
Well, there are different numbers globally and nationally, but we just hit a big benchmark globally, which is $5.2 trillion is the amount of money that institutions that have divested have access to. So it's a little bit of a complicated number, but it doesn't mean $5.2 trillion has been divested. It means institutions worth $5.2 trillion total, that those institutions have committed to divestment. So whatever percentage of their endowments that is, yeah. But it's a big benchmark, especially because it's it's doubling of the assets from last year.
Helen, talk about, universities are big players with large endowments, so they're fat pockets of money, useful targets for divestment. What are about other public utility entities like public employee pensions? New York is a populous and rich state. Is there a divestment campaign going on at the state government level in New York?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yes, there is a divestment movement in New York State, and the New York City and New York State comptrollers are both involved in negotiating for divestment currently. And a really interesting trend in the divestment movement generally has been that it began, and this is sort of a good sign for the movement, is that it began on college campuses as being really major sources of the money being divested. But at this point, pension funds, foundations, public entities, these really are where most of the money being divested is currently, which means that the movement has successfully spread beyond campuses, which is exactly what we wanted it to do. So college campuses now only account for about 13% of the money being divested, and that's a big shift from a couple years ago.
So from based on your comments earlier, it sounds like the college campuses are kind of holding down the shame angle, right? That your money's the money you have is big, but it's not nearly as big as things like state pension funds. And so you're sort of setting the moral tone and the precedent, and then other large institutional investors are feeling political pressure to follow. Is that correct?
That's exactly right.
All right.
Well, tell us about the trends in fossil fuel economics. What fuels are on the decline and why, and what's on the upswing?
You know, I don't know the specifics about the financial figures. And I think something that's really valuable to keep in mind with the divestment campaign is that this really isn't about knowing the finances and knowing, you know, the financial issues. This is a moral question. One sort of guiding comment that my mentors has told me in various spaces is the divestment movement and the students in the divestment movement. Sometimes we speak almost too smart. We speak to our audience. We deal with investment committees of our boards of trustees, and we don't need to change our language to speak their language. They work in the finance industry. We're not trying to work in the finance industry. We are trying to hold our universities accountable for morality and, you know, for the sake of our future. These are moral questions. These are ethical questions. It's really not about what is the right financial decision. They have the ability to figure that out for themselves. But we are trying to bring those moral questions to the forefront.
But there is an argument that some would make, right, that in the long run, sustainable energy is a more sustainable financially.
Yes.
Because certainly some fossil fuels have been crashing, right?
Yeah.
Do you want to say more on that, or you just want to let that go?
Well, I think that the trends definitely are going to be that sustainable energy is going to have to be what we invest in going forward, and it's going to be a sustainable investment as well. And it's really encouraging to see how that is being reflected in the financial literature. You know, investment funds are writing that themselves now. But like you said before, the sort of political pressure that has been building over the years is being absorbed into those financial institutions, and they're starting to realize it. So we're not taking that on as making those arguments ourselves. We know that once that becomes a political reality and an awareness that they have, financial institutions catch on.
And they talk about stranded assets.
Yes, that's right.
So the argument.
Yeah. So the argument goes that if 80% of fossil fuels cannot be burned, which is what Bill McKibben has argued, then 80% of fossil fuels and the sort of value of those fossil fuels that these companies hold they're stranded. They cannot actually be realized in a financial based on the value that they currently have. And if that's the case, then yes, a lot of these companies are going to be massively devalued, and that's true. So that's a really compelling argument for our trustees, for example. But the way that these financial institutions are talking about that is sort of becoming more mainstream now, which has done a lot of our work for us on that front.
So as we've discussed, in a way that students have led with coal swarm and other things like that, and now looking at other parts of oil and gas in the fossil fuel realm, and as we prepare to bring Will Parrish in to talk about the financial institutions off campus, how are students organizing, or how is the student movement connecting? Is it just rhetorical, or do you have actually organizing links with the broader anti-fossil fuel movement globally?
It's definitely broader than just on campuses. And I think that building those connections between other movements in the environmental justice realm is really sort of what has been the focus of the divestment campaign nationally this past year, and I think certainly going forward. One sort of element of the divestment movement that is really attempting to center connections to communities and connections to broader movement goals is the reinvestment campaign. So divestment is sort of a step one. You take your money out of a bad industry. But the idea is with reinvestment is that you then take that money and put it into the communities that have been harmed for so long. So if the fossil fuel industry has been harming communities with pollution, with water contamination, with destroying people's ability to have jobs that are not based on a single company, like in coal country, then the purpose of the divestment campaign can't simply be to take money out of this industry. It has to also inject money or support these communities in a way that is sustainable going forward, both economically and environmentally. So the divestment movement has really shifted in that direction recently, and I think that that is sort of the angle that's going to lead this movement forward well beyond the end of the divestment movement as an idea and moving forward into how can we build sustainable, not just financial ways of operating on college levels, but how can colleges connect to the communities around them and allow communities around them to be economically and environmentally strong without the sort of backdrop of the fossil industry that we've been dependent on for so long.
So that's interesting because, I mean, not only is it a social justice aspect, but it sort of takes money that might be God knows where on the planet, and it's calling for it to be more rooted in a just movement around that particular community. So that's a real relocalization thing effect as well, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, so now we've got so many more questions to ask you, Helen, but we also don't want to fail to hear from our other guest, Will Parrish. And so, Will, first, we have a whole battery of questions for you, too, but you've been very patiently listening, and I wonder if you want to make any comments before we go into any new questions on response to anything Helen has said so far.
I enjoyed listening to Helen and learned a lot, and I think I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. So we'll leap right into it. So you, Will, have written an article on Standing Rock and particular the presence of Native American people from all over Northern California at Standing Rock. And you've written another great article about Bay Area investors in the Dakota Access Pipeline and fracking and fossil fuels in general. Standing Rock itself has been a little bit out of the headlines, except for the blizzards and the sub-zero temperatures. But the resistance of at Standing Rock and the way it's been conducted has really changed this country already. So maybe just start out by telling us some of what you learned specifically about how it has affected and in part been created by Indian people from Northern California.
Right. Well, I traveled to Standing Rock in November, and as anyone who goes there will recall, you know, experiences, one of the most striking things about entering the encampment at Ocheti Sokoan is the corridor of flags that that greets you right as you enter the camp, which each flag represents a different indigenous nation that has visited Standing Rock. And there were over 300 of these flags at the time that I was at Standing Rock. So this is something that has galvanized indigenous people all over the United States, but also people from all corners of the world have visited Standing Rock and been a part of creating this struggle. So, of course, people from Northern California, not surprisingly, indigenous people such as the Pomo Nations where I live and other indigenous people throughout our region have also traveled out there and participated in things quite a bit, which I think pretty clearly reflects the sense of shared experience that indigenous people have. Lots of indigenous people have dealt with similar things in terms of the lack of consultation concerning sacred areas where development happens, dealing with threats to their water, threats to food supplies, trying to get recognition for their right to self-determination over their Aboriginal territories and so on. So there's a lot of parallels that people from areas like this who are indigenous and have dealt with similar things, you know, can recognize. And Standing Rock has become something that people see as affecting them, even if not directly, but through the kind of stand that people are making. They are making a statement that I think indigenous people see as being about indigenous sovereignty more broadly. Mm-hmm. So there have been many people from this area that I know of, and I'm sure many people from this area who I don't know of who have gone out there.
Yeah, that was actually sort of going to be my next question, that in your story you note that a lot of the conditions indigenous people are facing at Standing Rock, whether it's brutality by law enforcement, just the struggle to protect and inhabit land, to control, or I don't know if that's the right word, but to have stewardship over what white culture calls natural resources, and of course to get the treaty rights honored, that these are not new issues. And the way you write about it is that people going to Standing Rock and then talking about their own struggles, whether it's, you know, to take down the dams around the Klamath to protect the salmon, that they're sort of giving each other courage to go forward in their own struggles, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mentioned in the story a woman named Dana Colgrove, who I think you were just referring to, who's from the Hoopa Valley Nation up on the Klamath River in far northern California. And she's been part of efforts for years to get dams removed on the Klamath River to protect the Aboriginal food sources and the animals that are at the center of her people's culture, the salmon and other fish. And so I attended an event in Arcata several months ago now where she spoke, and she was at Standing Rock and talked about the extent to which, different indigenous nations from different parts of the country and world are sharing stories of their struggles out there. It's this incredible coming together of people who are exchanging information and ideas and stories about what they've all been through together. And so, of course, one of the groups that's been out there are the indigenous people from the Klamath, and they've been telling their stories. They have a kitchen set up. They've maintained a full-time presence out there with, various people cycling in and out from their part of the world. There's a big Hoopa camp that is clearly marked and a part of Ocheti Sakoan. So, the cultural exchange and the exchange of ideas and inspiration that is going on or has been going on out there for several months has been incredible, and I think we'll probably never really fully understand the effect that this is going to have in the long term, but it's really clear that people are carrying the spirit of the Standing Rock struggle with them, and that it's going to affect many people's lives, and they're going to carry what they've learned into many other struggles.
If you're just joining us, this is KWMR. You are listening to Post Carbon Radio, and that was the voice of Will Parrish, a courageous investigative journalist in the Bay Area who's been covering Standing Rock from a Northern California Native perspective. And we're about to get into the finance and money behind fossil fuels in the Bay Area. Also with us is Helen Kane, who is organizing against fossil fuel investment on college campuses in her campus and Barnard College. And we'll be back with more on both of those after a quick break. All right, so back to Will. We really want to get back to the money behind fossil fuels. In October, you wrote a great article in the North Bay Bohemian about a hedge fund right here in Marin County that has significant money invested in the fossil fuel industry, including the Dakota Access Pipeline. So can you tell us a little bit about that? Let's start with SCO Partners. Who are they and what do they do?
Right, so SCO Partners is based in Mill Valley, as you said, and the acronym SPO Partners is a reference to the three founders of the hedge fund, which include a guy named John Scully. He's the S in SPO Partners, and I'll come back to him in a second. That's why I mentioned his name. But they are a hedge fund. A hedge fund is, one way to think about a hedge fund is that it's a pool of investors who are small enough in number that they avoid the detailed reporting requirements of the U.S. Security and Exchange Commission.
How convenient.
So it's hard to know a lot of detail based on just gathering information from traditional public channels about them. But SPO Partners is the largest investor in a company called Oasis Petroleum, which is basically an oil extraction company based in northwestern North Dakota in the Bakken and Three Forks shale formations. They lease somewhere on the order of 400,000 acres. So they're a very large producer in that part of the country. And based on, what I know, and other people who've looked at, who is supplying the Dakota Access Pipeline, it's fairly clear that Oasis Petroleum is set up to be one of the main suppliers of oil to the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Yeah, it looked like it was one of six sort of oil tributaries going into the pipeline. Is that right?
That's right. There are six different smaller pipelines that are have been built or are being built in the Bakken area to carry oil to the Dakota Access Pipeline, you know, the tie-ins, as they call them, for the Dakota Access Pipeline to pump oil through the pipeline. So Oasis Petroleum has constructed one of those six pipelines, and a really good report came out about a month ago by a couple different groups, one of which is called the Sightline Institute based in Seattle, that looked at this deadline that is looming over the Dakota Access Pipeline construction in court. Energy Transfer Partners, you know, the main company building the pipeline, has claimed that on January 1st, the contracts they have with oil companies to supply the pipeline will expire. And if they weren't able to complete the pipeline by then, it would be a huge financial hardship for them, because then these companies could renegotiate the contracts. And, you know, assuming that's actually true, it's likely that Oasis Petroleum is one of those suppliers and will have the contract expire on January 1st. And so they face a moral question about whether they continue to be associated with the project after January 1st, and in what way if they do. And so, you know, Oasis Petroleum, because it's owned by SPO Partners, is subject to the decision-making of its investors to some degree. And so it will also be a moral question for SPO Partners, this hedge fund based in Marin County, as to whether they continue to be associated with the Dakota Access Pipeline project as a supplier. Without the suppliers like Oasis Petroleum, this project would collapse financially and wouldn't be able to make any money. That's how it would make money, is through having oil sold to it. That's the question facing this hedge fund right in Marin County, basically where you're sitting in the very same county.
And what is Donald Trump's involvement with the Dakota Access Pipeline?
Donald Trump is involved in various ways financially, and you know, I'm not an expert on all the ways that he's involved. Greenpeace did an excellent report that noted, I think, 8 to 10 different financial investments that he had that were linked to whether the Dakota Access Pipeline was built or not, whether, you know, through the fact that he was invested in Energy Transfer Partners, invested in oil companies that are supplying the pipeline, Phillips 66 being one of those. So he's got many different little fingers in the project. And you know, one of those happens to be through a hedge fund called Paulson & Company, which is also a major investor in Oasis Petroleum, the same company we've been talking about. The guy Paulson, who that hedge fund is named after, is actually was one of Donald Trump's main economic advisors during his presidential campaign. You know, he had a group of about 15 core advisors, and Paulson was one of them. And Trump happens to be invested in Paulson's hedge funds as well, which raises the possibility that he is an investor in Oasis Petroleum, this company that is set up to supply the Dakota Access Pipeline.
And just to be clear, we're talking about John Paulson, not Hank Paulson of
right,
the last bailout fame.
Exactly. Good distinction.
Yeah, and while we're mentioning companies in the Bay Area, two other big names that you mention, Wells Fargo and BlackRock. Want to lay it out what their roles are?
Right. Well, Wells Fargo is very involved in the Dakota Access Pipeline project. There was an excellent report that the group Food and Water Watch came out with in early September about the funding of the Dakota Access Pipeline, and they noted 38 different banks that are invested either in the project itself or in one of the companies that is involved in the consortium building the pipeline. So Wells Fargo is the second biggest investor, if I recall correctly, on their list. But beyond that, Wells Fargo is also the administrative agent, so-called, for Energy Transfer Partners, which, again, is the main construction company for the pipeline. And that basically means that they go out and help recruit funders for Energy Transfer Partners. They handle all of their interest and loan payments. You know, basically, they're a banker for Energy Transfer Partners. So they have a very core role in arranging the funding for the project, in addition to being a funder themselves. And Wells Fargo is actually the largest investor of any U.S.-based bank in oil and gas extraction projects worldwide, according to Thomson and Reuters study in 2014. And I would guess that, you know, we're sitting here in 2016, that's probably still the case. Wells Fargo holds about $42 billion in debt with the oil and gas industry. So this is a bank that, after the 2008 crash, came out in a pretty good position. They hadn't had the same kind of exposure to toxic loans and, you know, the subprime mortgage crisis that, that many other banks had had. And one of the choices they made in that position with, you know, the kind of leverage they had was to invest very heavily in more oil and gas production and extraction. You know, they became a huge investor in fracking operations. And so now that's, you know, because of the Dakota Access Pipeline struggle and the divestment movement that Helen described, that role is being exposed. And so they also face a choice going forward about how much they continue to be involved. And you know, there has been, as a result of the Dakota Access Pipeline, a growing interest in targeting banks like Wells Fargo and pressuring them to not be invested in fossil fuel extraction.
Yeah, we had a local action here in Point Reyes Station, a couple of them in front of our local branch, and I know in San Rafael there have been actions against Citibank.
We had one on campus as well.
Will, are you aware of anyone so far taking any street actions, since we're talking about street actions, with respect to SPO Partners or Oasis? What is the reaction to your article about them, Ben?
Well, it's had a good reaction. I've spoken with people who have read it, and this is, I believe, the third radio interview I've done about it. And so, people are interested in it. I'm not aware of any protests that have happened at this point, but I would say that because they are a supplier, because the supplier contracts probably expire January 1st, if Energy Transfer Partners court statements are to be believed, that now would be a very good time to focus more attention and bring more pressure on them, because they can influence whether Oasis Petroleum, this major supplier, actually provides oil to the pipeline.
So the they is SPO?
They is SPO Partners. That's
okay.
Right.
Well, one thing you write is, quote, the Wild West character of the Bakken region's oil industry has also left many companies prone to takeovers by private equity companies and hedge funds that invest in a variety of assets, largely avoiding direct regulatory oversight due to federal laws that exempt companies with relatively small numbers of investors from Securities and Exchange Commission reporting requirements. You mentioned that at the beginning. Can you say a little bit more about what's going on in terms of the takeovers in the industry and consolidation, and what impacts and implications that has?
Yeah, well, hedge funds have a tendency to target distressed assets for takeover. So, for example, a company's going bankrupt in somewhere like the Bakken Shale are prime targets for hedge fund investors right now, who figure that the financial stress facing the oil industry is temporary, that these companies still have important assets, and that they can sort of be nursed back to health as the price of oil goes up. And so SPO Partners is an example of that, because their investments in Oasis Petroleum began in earnest in 2014, when the price of oil collapsed and Bakken Shale companies faced a lot of financial stress. And so it's through their infusion of investment capital that these companies kind of come back to life in a lot of cases. I don't know enough in detail about Oasis Petroleum's, you know, financial condition to know whether they would have completely gone under had it not been for SBO Partners, for example. But there are cases where these hedge funds are responsible for companies coming back to life and being able to continue producing oil, which is something that is advantageous, obviously, for these hedge funds because they buy low, and then later on, after the value of the companies increase, they're able to sell high. And this Wild West character reference that I made has partly to do with how little regulation there is in North Dakota concerning labor laws, concerning environmental enforcement, and that's a big plus for a company like SPO Partners that's trying to maximize the value of its investment because, you know, if they can keep labor costs down, keep the cost of environmental compliance down, then obviously they make more money. So when I talk about the Wild West character, that's a big part of what I'm talking about, and that's one of the reasons why the worker death rate in the oil fields of North Dakota has been about seven times the national average in comparable areas of employment.
What? Didn't know that. Looks like Helen wants to jump in.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment about sort of seeing this exact trend on Barnard's campus, where the coal industry has been, you know, profits have just been plummeting over recent years. And in 2014, Barnard had no money in the coal industry, but Barnard is very heavily invested in trust funds. 60% is private equity of our endowment. And in 2015, we did invest in coal for the first time for that very reason, as a distressed asset, as a way of sort of making profit off of it. And it's this kind of bizarre trend over recent decades on college campuses of focusing on profit maximization, basically, over everything else. You see tuition rising at astronomical rates, while you also have endowments being invested in these extremely risky industries for the sake of profit. So you just see it really in all sectors.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. One thing I'll add in here is that one of the investors in Energy Transfer Partners is also the University of California's pension fund. Mm-hmm. Along with the California Public Employees Pension Fund, as well as the California Teachers Pension Fund.
So CalPERS and CalSTRS, right?
Right.
Who recently divested.
I'm sorry?
CalPERS and CalSTRS recently divested from fossil fuels.
They divested from coal,
yes.
But they are still invested, as far as I understand anyway, in fossil fuels, and that's been a struggle that people are continuing to undertake in California.
So they're still in oil and gas is what we're talking about, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's my understanding. And they certainly are invested in Energy Transfer Partners directly. And not only are they invested in Energy Transfer Partners, but their investments are in Energy Transfer Partners bonds, which is important because bonds are how the project is actually raising money for the construction itself. It's not just sort of a, you know, overall, you know, benefit to the company for its general operations. It's directly for construction.
I'd like to ask Helen, now that the report on divestment is finished, tell us about the sanctuary movement work you're interested in.
Well, yeah, the report came out at a very a time when a lot of change suddenly happened right after the Trump election. And I think this is true in the divestment movement generally, but the sort of shift towards broader justice movements that are occurring right now. So right after the Trump election, there was a massive movement, it's the hashtag Sanctuary Campus movement, and that was a really historic action. Over 100 colleges had a walkout on December 16th and 17th, one of the largest actions across college campuses in several decades. And we had about 1,000 students turn out at Columbia on very short notice, and a lot of the energy behind that movement has come from the divestment campaign. Not particularly because it was previously organized by the divestment campaign. COSECHA, which is Movimiento COSECHA, is an organization that's grassroots that has been working on this for a long time and been involved in the Dreamers and the No One Is Illegal movements. But the divestment movement, sort of by virtue of the fact that it has such a strong national and global network system, and the fact that it's so rooted in democratic financing and sort of a just transition that goes so much more beyond fossil fuel companies and going into what sustainability really means for autonomy and self-determination on an extremely local and global level, it has this level of flexibility that I think is somewhat unique among movements on college campuses right now. It's a very strong network of students involved in divestment that have been for the past 6 years now. And I was really impressed over, you know, a week or so after the election. Almost everyone I knew who popped up these sanctuary campus actions on their campuses had been involved in the fossil fuel divestment movement. So that was a really impressive action. And that movement is gaining steam a lot, like quite a bit right now, and growing across campuses. There's going to be another action in January. And of course, with the inauguration, just almost every student organization that's out there is mobilizing around that.
And do you think, is that because people have had a political education that they get it and are able to make the leap out of a single issue silo? Is it because they've learned the skills of democracy and they've made networks of people? Is it all of the above?
I think it's really all of the above. I think there are a lot of factors with the divestment movement that sort of lead it in those directions, all of those directions. One sort of piece of the puzzle that I think is really interesting is that the environmental movement for so long has really been a movement really dominated by white middle class activists. And because divestment has so much to do with taking the concept of environmentalism as individual actions and really saying that this is not about you choosing to recycle, you choosing to compost, you doing any kind of individual action. This is about structural issues that are deeply rooted in our economy, really every part of our global political system is involved and is complicit in the fact that climate change is where, you know, it's where we are today. And, you know, who has power is incredibly ingrained in these issues. So I think that in order to understand how divestment makes sense as a tactic, you have to start grappling with all of these issues, and you have to start grappling with who has power and why, and who has, you know, what that means for the economy, what that means for issues of race, of class, of gender, of, you know, indigenous peoples in this country, and colonialism and the history of colonialism. So I think that it really has been a political education for thousands of students across American campuses.
Yeah, I think it's a real teachable moment, and hopefully there'll be a quantum leap in galvanizing us on the left or liberal elements in the country.
Well, and all you people who are getting this political education and these skills are going to be coming out of your schools, and looking forward to seeing you there too.
No, that's right, and it's already it's already happening, because you're seeing already this generation of students that has been involved. I mean, the movement's 6 years old, and you know, people have already graduated who've been in this movement, and they're already starting to do some really incredible things. And I think the reinvestment movement and the solidarity economy movement, the Cosecha movement, all of these organizations that we're sort of seeing sprouting up, and the idea of a just transition, the idea that, you know, sustainable and green technologies, there's no guarantee that will be implemented in a democratic way. There's no guarantee that green technology or solar panels or hydro, any of that, will prioritize the well-being and like livelihoods of the people and the communities that it will impact. So I think that is sort of a new battleground, where a lot of the students who have graduated from this movement already are starting to join in on the front lines and to very much take up those struggles.
I just have to know how and to what degree this is infiltrating into the classroom.
I think it's really different at a lot of different schools. I go to a small liberal arts college, and it's a women's college, and so the concept of gender oppression is already very present, which I think can be an inroad that allows professors to take up issues of oppression beyond gender more easily. I'm lucky. I was able to take a lot of classes that were centering a lot of these issues already, and I think it's different for different professors. But I think the short answer is not enough. I think it can, and I think that right now, especially with the sort of dramatic shakeup of the fact that President Trump is going to be a reality soon, that has shaken professors up enough, at least at Barnard, to say, okay, it is no longer acceptable for us to talk about theory and not talk about the current political reality that is outside the classroom. And bringing the outside world and recent occurrences into the classroom, in the past month, I've noticed more than any of my years in school. Yeah, I think the short answer is not enough, but the fact that we're at such a critical moment is shaking professors up enough that there is some change happening.
Well, we're approaching the top of the hour. I'd like to give Will Parrish some final words.
Sure.
I'll give you some leading questions. Will, what are you up to next? How can people follow you? Where can we tune in to see your work?
Thank you. Well, I'll mention first that my website is www.willparrishreports.com.
And spell your last name.
Parrish is P-A-R-R-I-S-H, so two R's in there. And one of the things I'm working on that relates to the Just Transition movement, which Helen just mentioned, which I think is really important, is here in the Bay Area, as many people are probably aware, we have a very large oil refining sector. There are five oil refineries in the Bay Area counties, and in terms of a just transition, many of the people who have been leading the fight to rein in fossil fuel emissions or take on the fossil fuel industry and transition to a just, sustainable economy are the frontline, fence line communities in places like Richmond, where the Chevron oil refinery is located.
Yep.
And a major issue that's coming up that both of you may be aware of, I'm not certain, but the Bay Area Air Quality Management District, which is sort of the air district for the nine-county Bay Area region, has been considering emissions caps for the oil refineries in this area that would limit how many greenhouse gases they could pollute. And one of the reasons that's significant is that the Canadian oil sands, which are some of the dirtiest burning, one of the dirtiest burning forms of fossil fuels that is out there, has potential to be refined in far greater quantities in places like the Bay Area, because the refineries here are uniquely equipped to process what are called heavier versions of fossil fuel.
Right. They just retrofitted over the last couple of years for heavy crude, right?
Right. So having a cap on the emissions in the Bay Area would effectively preclude greater quantities of tar sands being refined in the Bay Area. And it would be the first time that any jurisdiction in the world has actually placed a limit on the greenhouse gas emissions of oil refineries. So we talk a lot about oil, big oil and
Will, I'm sorry I have to interrupt you, but we have to cut it off. We want to thank both our guests, Will Parrish. You can follow him at willparrish.com. Helen Kane from Barnard College. Do you have a Twitter handle you want to give out?
No Twitter handle. I'm sorry.
All right. Well, thank you so much to both of our guests. And please stay tuned for Cruisin' with Rick Clark.
I'm trying to spread the word about this immense issue, but I find it absurd why so many people are confused. Some people don't understand the weight of this problem. Act now before it gets out of hand, cause Earth is calling. I was 10 years old, exposed to it. The inconvenient truth really made me concerned how it was going to affect the youth. The temp is still rising from the pollution we produce. We need to start striving for a solution to reduce. When we burn fossil fuels like coal and gasoline, we're using dirty energies when we should be using clean. When we burn